Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Companies announce layoffs all the time, right? And it's easy to gloss over the big overall numbers. But what happens, do you suppose, when it's your town? Butte, Montana is about to lose a JCPenney. We'll tell you about that a little bit later. And how much do you know about Roger Ailes? A new book about the founder of Fox News on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 16th of January. Good to have you with us for the podcast, everybody. The list of losers on Wall Street today, the very worst performing of all American stocks out there, was led by ticker symbol BBY. Shares of Best Buy were down from the first sound of the opening bell all the way to the close, a 28% decline after reports of lousy holiday sales. It's just the latest in a long line of big box retailers that have run into some trouble. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to take a look at what's going on out there in the retail economy.
10 years ago, big box stores were the titans of retail. Small businesses were shutting their doors left and right because they couldn't compete with the likes of Costco, Best Buy, and Target on price and selection. Laura Kennedy is an analyst for Kantar Retail. She says the tables have turned on big box stores. They're now trying to figure out who their customers are and struggling to find them.
I think Seth Meyers made a joke on Saturday Night Live that
Toys R Us announced this week that its stores will remain open for 87 straight hours leading up to Christmas. Not to be outdone, the internet announced that it will be open all the time, always forever.
E-commerce accounts for around 6% of the retail economy. That number is growing fast, but if retail titans like Best Buy go down, it's a problem, says Brian Yarbrough, a consumer analyst at Edward Jones.
They do $45 billion in revenue, so it is a big deal, and retailers are realize they probably overexpanded and made the box too big over the years. When they close, it's not good for the economy.
The biggest issue? Jobs. Yarbrough points out big box stores employ thousands of people, from sales clerks to store managers. Still, he says many of those jobs will migrate along with our shopping habits.
You might lose a few people in the stores, but a lot of these retailers are ramping up hiring around systems and software and things, distribution centers. And I think that net-net, there's probably not a ton of job losses.
The economy has improved, but the average household has about 8% less income than it did before the recession. That gives another edge to online retailers, which can charge less for items because they don't have to pay for the big overhead of a big box store. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Even away from the big boxes, over in the chain department store industry, things aren't great. Macy's announced earlier this week it's cutting 2,500 jobs. Yesterday, it was JCPenney laying off 2,000 people and closing 33 stores, one of which is in Butte, Montana. Alana Furco is the manager of the Butte Plaza Mall. Penny is the anchor store there. Alana, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What does it mean to you out in real America that a big chain store is closing?
You know, devastating. And the idea that they could ever close never crossed my mind personally.
It's going to be what, about 30-something jobs, 32 jobs?
Right now, we're understanding 12 full-time and 20 part-time.
What happens, though, if you have a big, you know, this store closes on May the 3rd, they shut the doors, you have a big hole at the end of the mall?
Most definitely, we'll have a hole at the end of the mall as well as in our hearts. But, you know, we'll have to think outside the box. Maybe some new opportunities will present themselves. We'll have to repurpose and hopefully come up with something.
You sound very positive in face of what's not really positive news.
You know, I have to say, Kai, we're going to fight this, actually. We are not going to lay down, and we're definitely not going to stay down. We want JCPenney Corporate to reconsider the closure of the store in the Butte Plaza Mall.
Have you heard from them?
No, we haven't. No. You know, things are still shaky. A lot of emotion from yesterday. We're trying to calm ourselves and to refocus. And then we're going to build a local campaign just to show them how important our JCPenney is to Butte, Montana. And, you know, hopefully get them to change their mind.
What is it about Penny and Butte? Why is that store so important to you?
You know, from my standpoint, it's the working man's store. That's what it was when I was a little girl. It's been here for generations. grandparents took their grandkids to get new shoes for Easter. It was the very first credit card I ever got was my JCPenney credit card.
Wow.
It's iconic.
Do you shop there?
Absolutely. I shop there, Kai, before the announcement was made. I did not have a clue. Totally blindsided.
Not meaning any disrespect, but Penny says it's closing these 33 poorly performing stores.
Right.
You know, it's maybe, were there not a whole lot of people in and out and shopping in that place?
No, and I'm so glad that you asked about that because it is fact-based on low profitability. It really is. But these numbers, this low profitability period, there were a lot of circumstances, Kai. I mean, it's not based on sales or actual store performance. It's based on the profitability, which is after expenses. Now, during this time period that they looked at, the national economy was shaky. JCPenney corporate was changing leadership and the philosophy, and that affected us negatively. Plus, locally, we had some changes. We had a long-term manager leave. Plus, there was some remodeling. There were a lot of expenses on the store during that period of time. One of the analysts yesterday called it a perfect storm. I don't call it a perfect anything. It hurt the store.
Alana Furco is the manager at the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. They are losing their JCPenney store, maybe, on the 3rd of May. Alana, thanks very much.
Kai, take care.
It was a cautious day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House press office gave what's called a readout of a phone call that President Obama had with British Prime Minister David Cameron today. The president, quote, updated the prime minister on the ongoing U.S. signals intelligence review, end of quote. The American public gets its update tomorrow. The president is expected to give a big speech about proposed reforms to the NSA surveillance program. Technology companies, the first-line collectors of a lot of the data the NSA has, are going to be listening closely to that speech. Marketplace's Queen of Kim tells us what they hope to hear.
Bruff Turner is the founder and chief technology officer at NetBlazer, an internet service provider in Watertown, Massachusetts. And he says the first thing President Obama needs to do tomorrow is
stop the bulk collection of not just phone data, but internet data.
While a lot of attention has been paid to phone data, tech companies point out that the FISA Act also allows for the bulk collection of internet data, too. Turner's developing wireless products, and a few months ago, he was shopping it around Europe.
I was in Germany in October, and it was pretty clear that American services are completely suspicious and American products are somewhat suspicious. That was 3 months ago at this point. The situation is much more negative.
Turner says Obama can start putting some of these concerns at ease if he proposes a policy to protect the privacy of foreign internet users. Matt Simons is with ThoughtWorks, which builds custom software for businesses around the world. He says moving software to the cloud has in part fueled this tech boom, but
the darling of the tech sector is now clearly being questioned. People are seeking to build their own clouds. People are seeking to use clouds that are not storing their data inside the United States.
Simon says the NSA revelations appear to be having a bigger impact on small and medium-sized businesses. He says while there are few alternatives to Google, Facebook, and Amazon, the global competition for smaller-scale products is fierce. Stephen Cobbs is a researcher at ESET, a cybersecurity firm that protects company servers. He says one thing that's hitting all tech companies is the news that the NSA has built backdoors into security software.
It really sent a shiver through the security community because we know if you weaken it for the intelligence community, then the bad guys will exploit it too.
Cobb says before the Snowden revelations, the cybersecurity industry shared information with the government. Now that relationship has chilled. In San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
President Obama and the First Lady spent a good part of their day on education today. They met at the White House with more than 100 college and university presidents, as well as leaders from businesses, both for-profit and not, everybody trying to figure out how to get more low-income students into and through college. There are people whose actual job it is to do that. High school guidance counselors, if the kids can get in to see them. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott has the latest in her series, First in the Family.
When Tyler Lattimore was applying to college, he had to wait days to meet with the one counselor assigned to his high school in Gainesville, Florida. And when he did, she didn't seem to know much about the elite out-of-state colleges he was interested in. He's now a sophomore at Emory University in Atlanta.
I was actually fortunate to have a teacher who sat down with me after class and talked to me about my options. But the guidance counselors, I could not even imagine getting a hold of her long enough to do these kinds of things.
Meet the modern guidance counselor. Average caseload, 471 students. 471. Today's counselors juggle course advising, behavior problems, even coordinate standardized tests. When they do grab a few minutes to talk to students about college, they don't have much training to fall back on. After Michelle Obama launched her campaign to encourage more low-income students to get degrees, counselor Patrick O'Connor wrote her an open letter published by the Washington Post.
It's clear that the number one need of school counselors to help realize the goals Mrs. Obama was talking about was to get better training in college admission counseling, college advising.
O'Connor works at a private school in Michigan. He also teaches counselors. He says in most states, school counselors need a master's degree, but only a handful of programs even offer a course on college advising.
So, by and large, most counselors are leaving their master's degree programs with no formal training at any level of depth about how to help students.
With advice on things like financial aid or finding the right fit, Alexandria Walton Radford wrote the book Top Student, Top School. The top students she talked to were high school valedictorians. She looked at why so few from low-income backgrounds ended up in the most selective colleges.
What they encountered were counselors who often gave college information to students en masse.
The counselors tended to focus on schools they knew about, schools where middle-of-the-road students were likely to get in.
For those high-achieving high school students, those colleges did not tend to match their academic accomplishments.
That's known as undermatching, and it can really hurt low-income and first-generation college students who tend to do better at more selective schools. Radford says those are the students who need the most guidance.
What I found was that college counseling was pretty poor across the board, even in more affluent communities. But the difference was the families could make up for the lack of guidance being received through the schools.
Because the parents went to college themselves or could afford to pay for private counseling, public school counselors are aware of the bad reviews they get. A few years ago, the nonprofit research group Public Agenda surveyed hundreds of high school graduates. Most of them gave their counselors fair to poor marks.
It made me angry because here I'm working my tail off.
At Pikesville High School outside Baltimore, Jeremy Goldman has tried to learn on the job, sneaking in visits to college campuses on his vacation time.
All right, Miss India, so today we're going to talk about your five-year plan.
At nearby Woodlawn High School, Ashley Gallant tries to meet with each of her 10th graders, like India Griffin, at least a few times a year to start the college conversation.
Do you know what you want to do after high school?
Yes, I wanted to go to a performing arts school.
Okay.
To become a singer and a musician.
Okay.
These one-on-one meetings are getting harder to fit in. Gallant used to be one of five counselors at the school. They're down to four this year due to budget cuts, so she does more group meetings.
We definitely have to be a little bit more creative and resourceful with our time. We're having to do more with less, but that is, you know, pretty much how it is with most schools now.
And without a big boost in funding, it's not likely to get much better. The American School Counselor Association says there should be one counselor for every 250 students. But try selling that in cash-strapped districts like Philadelphia and communities across California, where many counselors have more than 1,000 students on their to-do lists. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They started getting complaints from viewers who were calling in to say that when they turned their TV off at night, the ghost image of the Fox News logo had been burned onto their TV screen.
Roger Ailes and the rise of Fox News. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dumped 64 points today, about a third of 1%, wrapped at 16,417, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ added 3 points, a 10%, finished at 4218. The S&P 500 unloaded 2 points, down a 10% at the bell, 1845. The number financials tripped up the markets today. Citigroup took off 4.33% after missing expectations. Goldman Sachs dropped 2% on falling profits. The transportation company CSX reported weak earnings and rolled down 6.8%. Today, United Health Group had a good quarter and forecast a good 2014 overall. So, of course, stock was down 2.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. It's the anniversary of the 6.7 magnitude Northridge earthquake that shook Los Angeles in the early morning hours 20 years ago with devastating effect. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for December, and First Lady Michelle Obama turns the big, fabulous 5-0. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I will tell you right up front, you are not going to believe what I am about to tell you. We learned this morning Chuck E. Cheese is going to be sold. Apollo Investments is going to take it private to the tune of, hang on to your hats, $1.3 billion. That's amazing because A, just because, as you know, if you've ever been in one, but also B, because the kiddie birthday party giant has seen some better days. So why spend all that money anyhow? Marketplace's Dan Wiseman has been asking around.
Here's a possible answer. Send Chuck to Russia and other former Soviet bloc countries. Here's Chris Christopher, who follows consumer behavior for IHS Global Insight.
Those countries didn't have very good restaurants until the Berlin Wall fell down. And now that things are very open and people have a little more spending money, they do dine out.
He says Chuck E. Cheese picks up a big advantage when he travels to the developing world.
American trademarks, especially on food, actually are very popular.
A private equity company could have the deep pockets and the flexibility to let Chuck try his luck abroad. And if you're shopping for a U.S. brand to export, Chuck E. Cheese is cheaper at $1.3 billion than, say, Pizza Hut. Back at home, the company has seen its same store sales fall in the last few years, even as the company has tried various updates. The trade publication Nation's Restaurant News keeps a top 100 list. In its most recent rankings, Chuck E. Cheese fell from 91 to 99. Editor Ron Ruggles has been reporting on the chain for 20 years. He says the entertainment side of the joint, the giant mouse, the video games, that kind of stuff, has seen the competition get much tougher in recent years.
So much entertainment is coming into the home now, it is difficult to offer something that's different than what people can get.
So even a rock and roll makeover for Chuck, which the company did in 2012, and did you know they turned him from a rat into a mouse, doesn't necessarily get more families in the door. Lynn Collier thinks she's been to Chuck E. Cheese at least 50 times. She's a stock analyst at Stern AG, and she's been looking at the company for almost 20 years. And she's got twin 5-year-old boys who love the place. She buys the idea that taking Chuck abroad is a likely strategy, but she does have one big myth to bust about the place.
I think the pizza is great. They've upgraded it in recent years, and I think the quality is pretty good at this point.
Okay. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
As one surveys the American corporate landscape, there are a few CEOs out there as successful, as influential, as powerful as Roger Ailes, the founder and president of Fox News. He started in daytime television with Mike Douglas back in the 60s, got into politics with Richard Nixon, and since starting Fox News in 1996, has built it into a multi-billion dollar business and a huge political force. Gabriel Sherman covers the media for New York Magazine, and he's out with his first book. It's all about Ailes and the rise of Fox News. It's called The Loudest Voice in the Room, How the Brilliant, Bombastic Roger Ailes Built Fox News and Divided a Country. Gabe, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
What's he really doing, Roger Ailes? Is he, as you say in the subtitle of your book, dividing the country, or is he being a really smart businessman in a time of declining television ratings?
He's doing both. I mean, he has reversed the economics of the TV news business by revolutionizing how news is packaged. He's, by using politics, he's figured out a business model that has allowed his network to generate twice the ratings of his competitors, CNN and MSNBC, as well as his profits exceed all of cable news and the broadcast evening news networks combined. So as a business story, it is an unparalleled success.
It seems to be basically he's got one rule, which is manage by fear. It's been remarkably successful both in ratings and profits and his professional success, but also in the loyalty, and this is a loaded word and people are going to write in about this, about the sycophancy that people within the Fox unit regard him.
Mm-hmm. There is a charisma about him that when you are in the family, you know, I think of Fox News like a family. And Roger Ailes is undeniably the head of that family. You know, they joke inside Fox News that the best show on the network is actually the 8 a.m. news meeting in Roger Ailes' office, where he monologues about the headlines and sets the kind of the message for the day. And he'll say things like, the Obama White House hates capitalism. Or one of my favorites is when he's monologuing about the ills of green energy. He'll say, you know, no one has died from nuclear power, but 15 people have been chopped up by those damn windmills. And so at one point, there was even a thought inside the company to put a camera in that room. And they thought it would be the best way to get ratings. I think that is a vivid example of his force of his personality, which is what makes him such a successful manager.
How directly is what we see on Fox News attributable to that 8 a.m. meeting and his personal political viewpoints?
Unquestionably, the entire network, from the colors on the screens to the right-wing blurbs that flash across the bottom of the screens, those are all recreated in his image.
Is his goal then, as you see it in this book and the, 3 years that you spent reporting it, is his goal to push his political agenda because its popularity makes him and Rupert Murdoch money, or is he making money so that he can push his political agenda?
I think there's a dance between those two things. I think without the profits, he has no ability to push his agenda. So Fox News is undeniably a business. It generates more than $1 billion of profit for Rupert Murdoch's, the parent company, 21st Century Fox Group. That said, the network exists to advance Roger Ailes' personal political agenda, which is right-wing politics. And what I report in the book is, in fact, Fox News has surpassed the GOP in terms of driving a message for where conservatives in America want their politicians to lead them. Fox News is more powerful than the GOP. Roger Ailes, in fact, joked after the 2012 election that the GOP couldn't organize a one-car funeral. So I think you see the kind of the power and the ego that his position allows him.
Is he giving his customers, his viewers, what they want, or is he telling them what they ought to want?
Well, that's the genius of the slogan, "We Report, You Decide," because no one wants to be told that they're getting kind of prepackaged spin. They want to feel like they're coming to the conclusions themselves. So the genius of the "We Report, You Decide" slogan is that he allowed his audience to feel that they were coming to the conclusions themselves. And it's been incredibly successful in building a loyal audience. You know, Fox News viewers watch the network longer, far longer than CNN and MSNBC viewers. And at one point early in the network's history, they had a static Fox News logo in the lower left side of the screen. And they started getting complaints from viewers who were calling in to say that when they turned their TV off at night, the ghost image of the Fox News logo had been burned onto their TV screen. So the graphics department at Fox developed a spinning logo that now, you know, you see it spins like a screensaver because the viewers were so hooked on it. And that is the genius of the marketing strategy.
I don't know if you were trying to do this or if it just that's the way the words, you know, came out of your computer. But you managed somehow, after spending 400-ish pages painting a picture of a guy who was bombastic and ruthless and egotistical and driven and mean, to make us feel sorry for him.
Mm-hmm. There is a deep sadness to where Roger Ailes has come to in his life. He sees the America that he grew up in Northeast Ohio in the 1940s and 50s slipping away. He has said it in meetings with his top advisors that he sees it as his role to save the Republic. And to me, it's a portrait of a man who is sitting atop an empire with a crumbling foundation, and he's clinging to power. And that's a very noble quest, but you can see that the end is at some point in sight, and that's a human story. That's not a political story. That's not a media story. Fundamentally, at the heart of my book, it's a human story, and he's a great American icon who has revolutionized the spheres of media and politics. And no matter what readers' political stripes are, I thought if I could make it a compelling human story, I could show them how he recreated these fields.
The book by Gabriel Sherman about Roger Ailes is called The Loudest Voice in the Room. It is, I will tell you, a fascinating read. Gabe, thanks a lot.
Thanks again.
My guess is you're going to have some thoughts on this one, so go ahead and tell me. Go to marketplace.org and click respond. It's right up at the top of the page there.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, something to think about, something to be aware of the next time you queue up the TiVo to record something. 30 years ago tomorrow, the Supreme Court of the United States said, in essence, it was okay to do that. The technology was firmly analog, videotape, but the principle was clear. The justices said home recording was fine. Copyright wise. Speaking, by the way, of old technologies, the case is known as the Sony Betamax case. When was the last time you saw one of those? Probably never, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. this Thursday. Today, the Dow off 64 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ added 3 points, a tenth of 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 2 points. That is a tenth of 1% as well. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.